Welcome to Blue Sky Banter, a conversation with legal luminaries about corporate governance, M&A, securities regulation, and more. It's Thursday, February 15th, and I'm Wren Holding, the editor of Columbia Law School's Blue Sky blog. Today, I'll be speaking with Donald Langvoort, the Thomas Aquinas Reynolds Professor of Law at Georgetown University Law Center, and a renowned authority on corporate and securities law and an occasional contributor to the Blue Sky blog. Welcome, Professor, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, here's what I'd like to talk about. In two recent articles, you've sort of zeroed in on the duty of companies to disclose information, which seems to be a never-ending conundrum for public corporations.
Absolutely.
In the first article, From Texas Gulf Sulphur to Chiarella, A Tale of Two Duties, you write about the imminent 50th anniversary of the Second Circuit's decision in Texas Gulf Sulphur, which held probably most famously, you say, that company insiders have a duty to disclose material non-public information or to abstain from trading on it. And in your second article, Disasters and Disclosures, you talk about how companies are basically flummoxed about when they have to disclose to avoid committing a fraud on the securities markets. So let's take the first paper first. You write about not just Texas Gulf Sulphur, but also what happened over the following 12 years, especially to the idea that all investors trading in a securities market should have essentially equal access to information, the so-called level playing field. Tell us about what happened during those years.
Well, there's a typical story that you hear today that Texas Gulf Sulphur embraced the idea that any insider who has an informational advantage, material non-public information,
right,
has a duty to disclose that merely by virtue of possessing it. Nothing more than that.
Right.
And indeed, that's when you read the language in Texas Gulf Sulphur, that's what it says. You can't deny that. 12 years later, the Supreme Court in the Chiarella case rejects that aspect of Texas Gulf Sulphur, says it was wrong, and therefore we need a new change in direction,
right,
a fiduciary-based duty of disclosure, and makes it seem like what was happening in the 12 years was this possession-based duty had flourished, was running amok, was interfering with market efficiency, such that it needed to put a stop to it.
Right.
And what I'm saying in this paper is that gets the history all wrong.
Yeah.
There's a question whether the Second Circuit ever meant that in the first place, whether that's the right reading. In any event, in the 12 years from 1968 to 1980, any notion of true market egalitarianism quickly got abandoned. Abandoned by the SEC, abandoned by increasingly the courts. So the story I tell is that by the time we get to 1980s, market egalitarianism and a duty based on possession had largely dissipated into a myth.
Well, now
a useful myth, perhaps,
right,
but a myth.
Right. Now the SEC, I mean, it won. Texas Gulf Sulphur. I mean, the court accepted its argument, and yet it. I think you mentioned by 1976, it essentially had disavowed market egalitarianism. Was that because it had second thoughts about its argument, or do you think the SEC essentially thought that the Second Circuit got it wrong, or at least didn't mean what it had said?
One of the fascinating things about doing what I call exercises in legal archaeology is I would love to be able to wake up the dead and have them tell me the story of all of this. I am reasonably convinced from all of the evidence that I've seen that the SEC never asked the Second Circuit for as broad a holding as it got.
Right.
The SEC had decided a number of years earlier, the Katie Roberts case, which was a much more nuanced, situational basis for the duty to disclose. It was open-ended, no doubt about that. But it wasn't mere possession gives rise to a duty. So my guess is the commission was as surprised as anybody when it saw the dicta, when it saw the language. What we do know is in the years from 1968, 69, 70, the early years right after Texas Gulf Sulphur, the SEC, every time it talked about insider trading, basically talked about its Katie Roberts decision and then said, as affirmed by the Supreme, by the Second Circuit in Texas Gulf Sulphur. Even the SEC was reluctant to go in the direction of taking possession to its logical conclusion.
So why did, as you, I think you say, why did the Second Circuit resurrect egalitarianism just to kill it? In other words, if it were already dead.
Well, the Supreme Court.
I'm sorry, the Supreme Court, right, in Chiarella.
And that's an interesting question as well. When the Chiarella case came up, and it percolated up through, of course, the district court as a criminal case, up to the Second Circuit, all the evidence that I am suggesting that both the SEC and the courts had moved well beyond possession, well beyond market egalitarianism, becomes clear. The Second Circuit explicitly, like the SEC did in 1976, said, we don't want market egalitarianism. It's an ideal. We don't want disruption of normal legitimate practices. When it went up to the Supreme Court, and this is, again, an interesting part of the archaeology, because it was a criminal case, instead of the SEC having control of the argument, the Solicitor General's office did.
It was actually the first criminal insider trading case, wasn't it?
Yes, it was the first to go through the judicial system. But so the Solicitor General's office, on behalf of the United States, has control. And Frank Easterbrook, obviously, we know him now as a brilliant academic, a judge on the Seventh Circuit, was the deputy Solicitor General who had, up until a few months before the papers get filed in this case, run the shop that handled these economic regulatory matters. And he, we know from his subsequent writings, wanted no part of market egalitarianism. As a result, even though he has left by the time the briefs are filed, the people who worked for him wrote a brief that is remarkable for not trying to defend the Second Circuit's decision on the grounds the Second Circuit articulated, but say completely, insider trading is properly characterized as misappropriation, and we are going to defend the conviction of Vincent Chiarella on grounds that he misappropriated and thus defrauded the source of the information, defrauded marketplace traders via theft. And the Supreme Court rejects that on grounds it wasn't properly charged to the jury. But of course, we know that subsequently, over the next decade or two, the misappropriation theory did make its appearance in insider trading law. But at the time Chiarella is being argued, there seems to be an amazing absence of anyone wanting to talk about egalitarianism and equal access. And I think the defense side takes that to their advantage. And poses it really as a boogeyman. Got to be really careful about insider trading law because this market egalitarian stuff can really interfere with market efficiency. And by 1980, that idea was getting lots of play in academia, on Wall Street. And so it was an effective boogeyman.
Right.
And Justice Powell, I think, reacts accordingly.
Well, and you mentioned, I think you call it strange and entirely inaccurate, something that Powell said about not being able to affirm Chiarella's conviction without recognizing that the duty to abstain or disclose. Why do you call that strange and inaccurate?
Right. And some people have pushed back on that who have been looking at my paper. The Second Circuit very clearly affirmed Chiarella's conviction while rejecting market egalitarianism. Mm-hmm. So, if what that sentence from Justice Powell is there is no alternative legal theory on which you can ground the conviction. According to the Second Circuit, that is completely wrong. The nuanced Katie Roberts-like approach to those with a special position of access was a different theory, was what the Second Circuit believed was properly charged to the jury in the case.
I think maybe I should interrupt just to make clear what the difference between what Katie Roberts was saying and what Texas Gulf Sulphur was saying.
Yes. Katie Roberts is a very open-ended opinion saying Rule 10b-5, the anti-fraud provision, principal anti-fraud provision under the securities laws, is properly applied to insider trading, that there must be a duty, and that the duty, and this is where the language is pretty vague, arises from a combination of unfair access to information and exploitation of that access. Mm-hmm. So somebody who's a market insider, a regular player, who as a result of economic power, friendships, affiliations, gets regular access to information. That person or that entity has a duty to abstain or disclose.
Okay.
Katie Roberts doesn't try to go any further than that ambit.
Right.
And over 12 years, the SEC shows its sensitivity to that.
Right.
Trying to draw that line with increasing clarity. That's what the Second Circuit affirmed. And Justice Powell seems to hide the fact that the law had moved on.
Yeah. Now, you also talk about a footnote in Texas Gulf Sulphur suggesting companies have an affirmative duty to disclose company secrets. That, I think you suggest, has led to all sorts of problems. Is that right?
Well, back when Texas Gulf Sulphur was decided, there was lots of discussion at the SEC and elsewhere about whether a company should, if it has a secret that would be market moving, have an obligation to reveal it.
Right.
Because Texas Gulf Sulphur went ahead and spoke anyway, that wasn't an issue in the case. But the court dropped a footnote suggesting that there is such an obligation, but there's also a business judgment principle at work that would allow a company to withhold information for legitimate competitive reasons.
Right. And which I think leads us to your second paper, Disasters and Disclosures. Is it fair to say that companies have very little idea about when they're allowed to conceal something? It's really almost a matter, I think you mentioned, of wordplay.
The law is a mess, and the law took a strange route from Texas Gulf Sulphur through the Chiarella case again.
Right.
Same story. As with respect to insider trading, once the court in Chiarella got it into its head that the only 10b-5 violations for silence come when there's a pre-existing duty to speak, the court was backed into a corner. If a company simply remains silent, does it have a pre-existing duty to speak, some duty that you can derive from some other principle, and the answer is no.
Right.
And very quickly, people saw that the insider trading holding in Chiarella also said something about corporations' duty to disclose. Right. But of course, silence is not consistent with the principles of the federal securities laws.
Right.
You know, it's full disclosure. It's not concealed disclosure. And so courts started experimenting with duties that arise mainly from the half-truth,
right,
saying something but not enough.
Right.
And that's where we've ended up today.
Yeah.
And I do, in my my paper on disasters and disclosures, explore the strange world in which a company bears no liability if it effectively hides the truth. Mm-hmm. But once it says a little bit too much, to use the phrase the courts use, puts the issue in play.
And you mentioned a wonderful example of that, I think, which I had to laugh, not because it wasn't a terrible tragedy, but it was just it was kind of an amazing story involving the Brazilian dam case. Can you tell us a little about that?
Sure. And it's just a good example of what, the muddle that I'm talking about. And to an academic, it's just a lovely natural experiment to test out a hypothesis. Brazil suffered a miserably horrible environmental disaster when a dam that was holding back toxic sludge collapsed so that the sludge moved down deaths, environmental wreckage, and all ensued. The dam was owned by a joint venture that was controlled by two global companies, and both global companies allegedly had knowledge that there were warnings about the safety of the dam, that it was not as secure as it should be, that something needed to be done.
Right.
Nonetheless, those warnings, concerns about the Fundão Dam, were never disclosed. Both companies talked about safety, talked about their commitments in almost identical language. So what they put in play is hard to distinguish as between the two.
Right.
But because they were separate global companies, any lawsuit against them would have to proceed separately. So we have class actions against each of the companies for nearly identical statements.
What kind of language?
We are committed to safety. You know, marble mouths, things like that.
Right.
Committed to safety. We will not let our employees be put in harm's way. Things like that.
Right.
That, you know, you
very
can imagine
very general statements.
Very general, but something that a listener would readily associate with. Well, we know that this company has the dam. And so you can imagine a court saying, as one of the judges did,
right,
that you could have said nothing about this, but once you started talking about not putting your employees in harm's way, it was misleading not to reveal that you were indeed doing exactly that.
Right.
The other judge, same set of facts, says just the opposite, which is no human being with any brain at all would associate any substantive content with such marble mouth generalities.
Right. So who was right? Which judge was right?
My paper takes the position, not surprisingly, that our system of disclosure is meant to force revelation, not just give a company the option. And so I lean toward a contextualist approach that doesn't simply say, well, you use generalities, therefore you have to speak,
right,
but rather looks back at what I call the conversation that is going on. Normally, the reason somebody is speaking these words is because they've been asked a question.
Right.
And the question is often motivated these days by sustainability issues.
Mm-hmm.
Institutional investors are under immense pressure moving forward the debate on, are companies prepared for disasters? And so if you can identify what the company said as part of a conversation where investors are essentially saying, we want to know about this, tell us,
right,
I think they are entitled to take the answer they get as not just wordplay, but an honest assessment of the issue.
Right. And you mentioned that this is a big issue, social responsibility, particularly environmental, but in any sort of, you know, the ESG categories, environmental, social.
Right. And just in the last couple of days, the SEC has reinforced this with respect to cybersecurity.
Right.
You know, everybody is now asking companies to assess the risk level associated with potential hacking.
Yeah.
And so we now have the SEC saying, add this to environmental in terms of the conversation you need to be having with your investors.
I don't know how closely you looked at them, but did you have any sense of whether those guidelines that were released the other day are good, bad, adequate, clear?
They're better than they were. This is not the first time the SEC has addressed cybersecurity, but it goes back to 2011, and the state of concern and alarm about cybersecurity was lesser in 2011 than it is in 2018.
Sure.
But no one is solving the problem of the absence of specific directives to companies to engage in, you know, early warning systems to the investment community. We still go back to the management discussion analysis, risk factor disclosures, which in the past haven't been very well enforced and haven't really delivered dependable warnings to investors. I think, you know, the SEC is going to have to back up this kind of guidance with enforcement action.
Right.
But these days it's not, you know, the kind of commission that wants to go out guns ablaze.
Right. Right. I want to leave you with one last question, and that is, do you think that securities law would have been better without Chiarella, in the sense that it would have been better to let the efforts to refine Texas Gulf Sulfur's holdings play out as they really were before Chiarella, and Chiarella sort of ended that process? What do you think about that?
I think yes, in the sense that if you wanted to develop good disclosure policy, you've got to acknowledge that there are some risks, some bad news sometimes buried in corporations that should be disclosed, that there's no legitimate reason not to disclose. And I think the idea that footnote in Texas Gulf Sulfur espoused, which is normally you do have a duty, you can be absolved from liability if you have a legitimate, compelling business need to either defer or delay the security.
Right.
That's an idea that I think comes closer to getting us an optimal disclosure policy than the wordplay mess we're in now.
Right.
So in that sense, I think it's very unfortunate that Chiarella backed the law of disclosure into a corner and left very unappealing routes to getting out.
Of course, you'd still have the question, what is a legitimate business
reason? And, you know, fraud on the market suits, you know, are often billion-dollar lawsuits.
Right.
And we do have to understand that there's a chilling effect that can come from liability if courts are not confident that if corporations are not confident that courts will apply it fairly.
Right.
But I think that could have been worked out. There are other areas of law where the law stabilized with good compromises that put us in a better place than we would have been.
Right, right. Interesting stuff. We're going to have to leave it there. Professor Langvoort, I want to thank you again for being with us.
Happy to be here.
And listeners, join us again soon for another edition of Blue Sky Banter.